Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. In this first hour of the show, we'll be talking with novelist Caleb Carr. You may know Caleb Carr as the author of a couple of best-selling historical thrillers, books that were set in New York City at the turn of the century, those books The Alienist and The Angel of Darkness. He has just published a new book that is science fiction and is set in the near future. The book is titled Killing Time, and it's just recently come out. It's published by Random House, and this morning on Focus, we'll talk a little bit about that book and about some of the other work that Caleb Carr has done. And as we do that, of course, people who are listening are welcome to call in if you want to ask questions. All we ask callers is people just try to be brief so that we can keep things moving along and make room for everyone or anyone who likes to call in. Other than that, all calls and questions are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois, Indiana, anywhere that signal will travel. That's 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. That's what you get if you match the numbers and the letters. 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Carr, hello.
Yes.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let's set the stage for Killing Time and talk a little bit about the world as you envision it in 2023. And it's not a terribly appealing place. We had a worldwide economic collapse early in the century, a Staphylococcus epidemic that killed a lot of people. The ocean is polluted and doesn't have much in the way of fish anymore. People in Southern California fighting over water. India and Pakistan have fought a nuclear war over Kashmir. Maybe I'll stop there. it's a dystopia for certain.
Yeah, it's a cautionary tale. I make no bones about that. I don't necessarily think this is the way things will be, but I did want to issue a pretty stern warning about problems that I saw going unaddressed amidst all the globalization hoopla that's been taking place over the last several years. It seemed to me that there were many problems that were just getting swept under the carpet and left undealt with. So I wanted to write a story about what would happen if a lot of those problems continue to go untreated for another quarter century or so. And then Time magazine came to me fairly early on in the process and by coincidence wanted to publish a serialized fiction in the magazine for the first time in its history and asked me, they were doing some millennial issues, and asked me if I could do something that would take place in the near future. And I told them that I could and I would. So that was how the first part of the book came to be, and then I went on and completed the rest of it for the published work.
Hmm. I came across an interview that you did in Salon a couple of years ago, and they asked you I'm not sure if they were asking about science fiction or historical fiction or whatever, but the answer that you gave them I thought was interesting and also quite correct, and that is whether you're talking about historical fiction or science fiction, it's not so much about the past or the future. It's about whenever it is that thing happened to be written.
Yeah, writers are always writing about the present, essentially. We can't truly know the past any more than only just slightly more than we can truly know the future. We're looking at the present through a specific lens in order to entertain the audience, in order to, you know, give the audience some things that part of a writer's job is simply to, you know, entertain and divert, a job that too many writers today don't seem to remember as part of their job, but that is a huge part of a writer's job. And so you use that lens to give the reader something interesting and different to view it through, but you're making points about the present through those lenses.
Mm-hmm. The two books that I mentioned, The Alienist and The Angel of Darkness, are set in New York City, and I know that you spent a lot of time researching the city and the period to try to lend some authenticity to the details in the story. So there you're somewhat limited by past reality. In science fiction, I think the part of the appeal of that to readers and writers, I'm sure, is that you can virtually write anything that you want.
You can virtually do it, but if you're, it's the same thing as historical fiction. If you're going to write plausible historical fiction, you have to tie yourself pretty tightly to what happened and pretty tightly to what people actually did. And if you're going to, for instance, with The Alienist, I confine myself with historical characters. I confine them to sort of what we'd call in movies cameo roles. And I didn't have them ever do anything that they didn't actually do in the record, on the record. And I didn't have them, as much as possible, the language that they used, real figures in the books, was language that they used somewhere else, either in a letter or some kind of a document, speech, whatever. And so to make it plausible, you stick as much as possible to the fact. And I think with futuristic stuff, especially if it's the near future, you have to do as much as possible the same thing, which is really study the current, you know, scientific, social, political conditions and extrapolate in a reasonable fashion, not in a sensational fashion. And I think what that meant for me was that this book required really just as much research as the others did. And that was kind of surprising in a way that it did, because there's such a huge literature now of speculative science, of speculative history, asking what's going to happen in the immediate future. And you really have to familiarize yourself with it and understand it. So it was surprising to me how much research had to be done for the future. It was how much I had to stick to things that were, because I am a political and military historian by training, and that is, I have a pretty rigorous approach toward either speculating or recreating, and I don't like stuff that you read that's, you know, 50 years in the future and anything has happened. Mm-hmm. I like things that are really spun out very, very plausibly from what exists now.
Our guest in this part of Focus, Caleb Carr. He's a novelist. He's the author of the bestsellers The Alienist and The Angel of Darkness. He's also written several volumes of nonfiction. He writes often on military and political affairs. He's an editorial advisor to the World Policy Journal and also MHQ, the Quarterly Journal of Military History. And his new book is Killing Time. It's published by Random House. And questions are welcome. 333-WYLL, toll-free 800-222-WYLL. The narrator of Killing Time is a psychiatrist from New York, a criminal profiler, and actually rather reminds me of The Alienist. Is this man a descendant of Laszlo Chrysler?
No. They really only share professions. He's more spiritually. He's sort of more akin to John Moore, the narrator of The Alienist, the first of those books. He's really, again, it's the use of the kind of everyman character. He has a slightly more interesting job, but really a character who is having a pretty good life in the situation as it exists in the future, and then is drawn into by way of a couple of murders, is drawn into this dramatic adventure that he undertakes, and is brought face to face with the harsh realities of the time he lives in. But he's the kind of person, like most people, who would only be brought face-to-face to those harsh realities through something extraordinary, and only if he had to, because they are pretty harsh.
Mm-hmm.
So you really use a character like that because it's the easiest way to take the audience on the journey. It's that, you know, he sees things with shock and surprise, and therefore we all see it with shock and surprise.
Mm. It does, though. I guess it leads me to think that, or to want to ask you about your interest in the criminal mind, and
sure.
in the workings of the human mind. It certainly does seem to be something that does interest you.
Yeah, that is definitely reflected in his occupation. I definitely have a desire to understand the criminal and the violent mind, and it's been an interest of mine really forever because, you know, history, as I view it, really is just psychology. And, you know, history is the history of people and what motivates them and, you know, all of their great historical characters, all of the influences that shape them early in their lives, throughout their lives, the personal influences, as well as the high political drama.
Hmm.
So that was how I got interested in psychology, was through history, was through studying historical characters. And then it became a more specific study later on in my life. It was never a formal study for me in the sense that I attended school for psychology, but I sort of did the Abe Lincoln route for myself with taking a pretty rigorous course of psychological study, and also studying 19th century psychology, which, believe me, is no easy undertaking. Hmm. 19th century medical literature, that was really the hardest part of the research I did for those books, was the 19th century medical literature, which is pretty thick going. But you have to do it. You have to really, you have to understand it so that your characters, again, speak plausibly, so that they don't speak anachronistically in the language of the 20th century, but rather in the language that they were speaking at the time. Hmm.
One of the things that you have put in the resume of this character we're talking about, Gideon Wolfe, is a psychological history of the United States.
Right.
That he has written, and that's part of the reason that this cast of characters that he becomes part of is interested in him.
Right. He writes best-selling books. It's called The Psychological History of the United States, which, by the way, is something I'd love to do someday myself, which is basically he goes through American history sort of psychoanalyzing the famous history figures of American history and trying to figure out why, you know, how much their personal psychological history has to do with the way the country was shaped. And these characters who are up to this strange bit of business that they're up to of trying to expose some of the dangers of modern society, they really want to have a good historical profiler so that they can. They're being pursued by various and sundry nations and enemies, and they would like to have a good idea of how the people that they are struggling against will react to things that they do.
Hmm. I think that some historians have tried to do this, but it strikes me that it's sometimes difficult, that one's on sometimes thin ice, intellectually speaking, because you're drawing a lot of inference, and it's often hard to have real hard data to make these conclusions. And
but it's remarkable, actually, how much hard data there is. There is an incredible prejudice against psychology among traditional historians, in much the same way there is among local police departments. They are so suspicious and hostile toward psychological profiling. I actually did do this with a friend of mine, James Chase. We wrote a book once together called America Invulnerable, which was a history of American national security policy from 1812 to the present. And it really sort of laid open a lot of common threads in the way that America reacts to threat around the world and the way that America perceives threat around the world. And you really can see some extremely consistent behavior based on some early experiences. And it was Henry Adams, the great historian and great-grandson and grandson of presidents, turn-of-century historian, said that, to determining a national character is the most difficult and the most important historical problem that exists. And it's really true. And we tried to do that just in the one area of American national security policy and the way that America responds to threat. And the hostility with which we were received by the traditional historical community historians, was really fantastic. I mean, it was unbelievable how hostile most of them were. A great many other people were not. People who were not academic historians, people who were not, people who were very historically brilliant, some of them, but really traditional historians don't like that. And it's the same kind of prejudice you do see among police, you see among a lot of different communities. Psychoanalysis is really, it's still something that makes a lot of people tremendously uncomfortable. And when you turn it on figures in history, particularly beloved figures in history, it can make people extremely uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. We talked a little bit right at the beginning about what the world looks like in 2023 and the fact that what you have done is taken many very contemporary concerns, things that we're talking about now, mm-hmm. and simply played them out to their logical conclusions,
exactly.
and sort of had them all play out at the same time. So it's as if we took all of the things that we worry now individually about future problems and said, let them all rip and see where they go. And one of the things that is important, in a sense, almost an important character in the book is the Internet.
Yes. The Internet is sort of the trigger for a lot of bad things, which is the way that I view it now. You're right. The setting of the book is basically saying there's a lot of problems that exist right now that get extrapolated to their worst degree all at the same time. And my feeling is that there are going to be a couple of events. The world economic and political society right now, I view as extremely fragile. Perhaps the most fragile thing about it is how much people are convinced that it's not fragile. And all we need is one serious economic crisis, which we will probably get in the next 10 years, one serious world health crisis of a really pandemic scale, which we will probably get in the next 10 to 15 years. And our system may be overburdened to the point where we will see tremendous social steps backward worldwide. And one of the things, it seems to me, that is causing people not to look at this is an obsession with commerce and marketing. And I don't mean to say that in any sort of left-wing way. I hold no brief for the left any more than I do for the right. I am an extremely politically centrist-oriented person. But the madness of the globalization phenomenon in terms of getting people obsessed with consumer goods, particularly American consumer goods, to the exclusion of almost everything else, seems to me to be the great sort of, again, I hate to use a Marxist word, but that seems to me to be the great opiate that is making people ignore extremely fundamental problems. And the delivery system for all of that right now is the Internet, which is the system that carries not only the machinery of globalization and international marketing into every home, but the mentality of it. By getting people online, keeping people online, learning everything we can about people by having them online and then invading their computers and sort of profiling them commercially, it seems to me to be the great path by which all of this is happening. It's the great symbol and the great instrument of this globalization and this marketing phenomenon. So the Internet does get set up as sort of the thing that these people are really worried about. And the worst thing about the Internet itself is a tool. It's not evil in and of itself any more than television is. But what is evil that's going on is that the Internet is so pervasive and so unregulated. And all I'm really calling for in the book in terms of the Internet is for some kind of sensible, rigorous, but enlightened regulation of the Internet in a way that we already regulate television, movies, books, printed matter, anything. And what I mean by that is that certain materials should not be allowed. All information available on the Internet should be verifiable. Right now we have no way of knowing what on the Internet is true or not true. You can put anything up on the Internet that you feel like without any severe worry about legal action. It's wide open country on the net right now, and that's a fundamentally dangerous situation, and it's been recognized as such by a lot of people who are responsible for its popularization, most notably William Gibson, who's an author I respect and admire very much, who's extremely concerned about the state, about the influence that the Internet is taking on.
And I promise we'll not give too much of the story away, but maybe we'll just say that what the cast of characters that your narrator, Dr. Wolf, falls in with do is they perpetrate a series of hoaxes that they create. That first they create, they and use the Internet to circulate, and then say, aha, you see? No, this is not true. We made it up as a way of trying to get people to question generally the information content that's
exactly. That we're all... Exactly. What they're attempting to do is to alert the world to how susceptible it is, society is, to manipulation by political and commercial forces, by themselves manipulating events through these series of grand hoaxes which they perpetrate and which they expect to be discovered eventually, one of which is the assassination of an American president, which they change the visual evidence of it so that the wrong person is convicted of the crime and the wrong country ends up being punished for it by the American military. And it is there what they attempt to do is to create these hoaxes, and then when the public doesn't realize that they are hoaxes, they even go so far as to provide hints and finally open statements that these are hoaxes, but they discover that for some reason people are unwilling to accept that they're hoaxes, partly because they're so good and partly because there's something inside people that wants to believe hoaxes. And that becomes a sort of the psychological crux of the book, is the issue of why do people believe things? Why do each of us, even in our intimate personal lives, why do we believe things that we know to be untrue? Why is it necessary to believe them in order to get through every day? And each of us does have things that we know secretly are not true, generally, in our lives, that we still tell ourselves are true. Because for some reason, whether it's within a personal relationship or a job or whatever, we just need to believe that in order to keep going, in order to make the situation bearable.
The leader of this group of people has as his motto, and it's a phrase that comes up frequently in the book, is the world wants to be deceived.
Right. It's the old Latin expression, which means the world wants to be deceived. And that really is the core of the book. That is an ancient proverb. And it has remained a very true proverb. And why is that so? Why has it remained such a constant in human society?
We're already at the midpoint of this part of Focus. We're talking with Caleb Carr. He's the author of the bestsellers The Alienist and The Angel of Darkness. And his newest book is titled Killing Time, published by Random House. It's a science fiction work set in the near future and is out now if you certainly want to read the book. And if you'd like to talk with our guest, you can do that too. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. We have a couple of callers here. We'll start in Freeport, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes?
I don't know if you've read his book or not, by Professor James H. Fetzer, University of Minnesota, Duluth, called Assassination Science. 463 pages on the John F. Kennedy assassination, and he carefully delineates the power of the industrial military complex and all the big powerful wheel horses in Washington, like Johnson, Hoover of the FBI, and Richard Nixon in those times. And it seems to me we're living in a nightmare now. Many writers have said that the government, the shadow government, took over, and we continued the war in Vietnam, you know, 58,000 U.S. deaths, and the income of the workers has gone down, presaging all this, Jack London, around 1900, a great socialist writer, wrote The Iron Heel, in which he also wrote about an industrial-military oligarchy that ruled over society and the struggles of the workers against it and the nightmare conditions people lived under. You follow me?
Yes, no. The London book is a wonderful book, and Jack London, of course, was a great man. And I think that's part of his work that is not very well known, and it deserves to be more well known, because there's a great parallel between what's going on today and what went on 100 years ago, which is that 100 years ago we had a completely, besides having the most politically corrupt society right now that we have had in 100 years, what we had 100 years ago was a society in which the basic conditions of workers' lives, labor, food, drugs, were completely unregulated. And this is what I'm talking about when I talk about regulation. I'm not talking about anything radical or even socialist. I'm talking about really basic enlightened regulation. And what happened was, when Theodore Roosevelt became president, he simply, for his own reasons, decided that he was going to guarantee a basic quality of life for workers, limiting their hours, eliminating child labor, making sure there were certain food and drug standards that had to be abided by. What we need today are the same things, but not in terms of labor and food and drugs, but in terms of what's going into our children's and our own minds, those delivery systems, which are under the general heading of information technologies, they are completely unregulated today. So what we have is a similar condition to 100 years ago that needs to be addressed through some very practical, rigorous, enlightened regulation. Now, because of the fact that those information technologies are driving this great economic boom that we're living through, it is entirely unlikely that the average politician in Washington is going to do anything except go after the lobbying dollars of those technologies, which means there will be no regulation. And I am very pessimistic about the idea of anything stopping all of this. But so were people like Jack London in 1900. No one predicted that Theodore Roosevelt was going to come along and, by accident of McKinley's assassination, become president. And it was a very happy surprise for people like Jack London. And that possibility always exists, that someone will emerge from out of nowhere who, simply by virtue of being honest and being ready to take up the struggle, will take on some of these interests. But, you know, you never can depend on that. So it's not a happy moment.
Well, I appreciate the comments of the call. Let's go to Urbana here for somebody else. Line one. Hello.
Hello. I was very interested in something you said much earlier in the program, and I wasn't near a phone at the time, so you may have already talked a little bit about this, but I'm very interested in historians and why historians write history and how they write history. And you said something very interesting about novelists. You said whether a novelist is writing about the past or really writing about the future, they actually are writing about the present. And I thought I would just speculate that perhaps that historians are doing the same thing.
To a certain extent, yes. Historians, and even more on a personal level, historians are often doing the same thing. Historians love to believe that they have attained a sort of a state of ultimate objectivity, and so it's almost a state of Buddhist bliss for them, that they think that they a holy grail that exists for them, that they are no longer personally involved in their work at all, and that's of course never true. Psychologically, it's an absurdity. A lot of historians are really working out things they feel about the world around them, and even things that they feel about, you know, things they feel personally, a lot of their emotional feelings, they're working out in the way in which they choose to interpret history. And that's why you get so many different interpretations of history.
Mm-hmm.
It's because a lot of them are extremely personal. Now, some of the best history that's ever been written is extremely personally slanted, which is why it's always good to read four or five different views of the same event before you come to believe anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the most beloved historians that we have in the world are people who took an entirely personal and prejudiced slant
mm-hmm.
toward these things. You do see the exact same thing happening with historians.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call. And again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free. 800-222-9455. I was very interested in the comments you made to the previous caller about the parallels that exist between the place we are now and where we were 100 years ago. And I also was thinking that, in the material that came with the book, some comparisons are made between Killing Time and work of other writers like H.G. Wells and George Orwell. But the man who I thought of as I was reading it, who, interestingly enough, is sort of roughly contemporary with the characters of The Alienist and The Angel of Darkness, the guy I thought about was Jules Verne.
Yes, of course.
And that also somehow your character, Malcolm Tressalian, in Killing Time, somehow puts me in mind of Captain Nemo.
He has a bit of Captain Nemo in him. He has, not obviously physically or in terms of his personal style, but in terms of his of a kind of a mission that he feels himself to be on. Now, I hasten to add, much of that mission that we associate with Captain Nemo, if you go back and reread 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and Mysterious Island, the two books that Captain Nemo appears in, much of that specific mission that we associate with Captain Nemo to sort of, end war and end world hunger and all these kinds of things, that was really created by Walt Disney. By a British director named Cyrus Harding during Cyrus Harding's the character in the book. In the two movies that were done of those books, Verne was much more concerned purely with the sort of the science and the adventure. He was not so much of a moral interpreter of events. And we really, Walt Disney added an enormous moral dimension and mission. He heightened all that about Captain Nemo's character. And it's fascinating to me how much that has become an equal, you know, Captain Nemo has become a popular figure in the figure in the popular imagination, as much because of an interpreter as because of his creator, which is always interesting when that happens. But definitely, the book owes a huge debt. I read Jules Verne when I was a kid. There's a third book, however, that the book really much more is much more drawn from, which is called Master of the World, that Jules Verne wrote. And that was a book which actually Walt Disney borrowed from a great deal in order to flesh out the character of Captain Nemo in his film version. There's a character in that book called Rober the Conqueror, who's a much more morally high-minded man on a mission, even more than Captain Nemo. And it's because it's a sort of a shorter and more fun book in some ways than 20,000 Leagues, which is packed with endless chapters about forms of sea life. It's almost a lexicon of 19th century knowledge of undersea life, much of which Verne just took from textbooks or even made up, never having been under the ocean himself. Master of the World is a much more direct influence on Killing Time than even 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. But I make no bones in the book about it. There are many little subtle little sort of tips of the hat in terms of character name or places or things in the book. There are many tips of the hat to many of the ninth great turn of the century and late 19th century adventure and science fiction writers, which were totally intentional in Killing Time, because the book really is a sort of an homage to that kind of story. It's not really the typical sort of late 20th century, early 21st century story about the future, in the sense that it is not concerned with, it's written in a very sort of traditional 19th century style, and it's meant to be almost a book of that period as much as The Alienist is, and it's sort of a piece with those other two books because of that. But I don't for a second attempt to deny my indebtedness to Verne, to Wells, Robert Louis Stevenson, all these kind of people. We're huge influences on me from when I was young throughout my life, still are.
I'm looking for in that same Salon interview that I talked about a little while ago. I'm looking for a quote, and now I can't find it. Well, I guess, yeah, it's where someone asks you about having done a lot of historical research and how you get yourself into the mind frame to write. And here they were talking about The Alienist and Angel of Darkness, and you said something like, I've always lived more in the past than in the present, in my aesthetic sense, my ethical sense. Is that something you can expand on?
Well, yeah. I mean, well, obviously, the aesthetic sense is simply a question of I find both the philosophy and the product of 19th century, late 19th and early 20th century art to be something that I am just more in tune with, art or culture generally, something that I am more in tune with. And one of the reasons I'm more in tune with it is that there is a very powerful ethical and moral component to late 19th century, early 20th century culture. And it's a component that I think is really lacking in modern culture. There's a real attempt, and one of the things that was really important in the late 19th century, and one of the reasons I feel that so many things of lasting value were created then, was an attempt to combine the extremely beautiful or the extremely profound or whatever with to combine that with some kind of method that would make it accessible to the public on a broad basis. One of the reasons that the great buildings that you see that exist from the late 19th century, one of the reasons that we still all understand them as well as we do, and one of the reasons we can all still look at them and appreciate their beauty, is because they were intended to be understood by people who had no knowledge of architecture, for instance. Buildings that are built today, if you don't have about a six-year degree in architecture, the average person is going to think that most buildings that are built today are simply ugly. And by the, even after you get those 6 years of study that allowed you to look at them and say, oh, well, I understand what he was trying to do now, finally. Maybe it looks a little bit better, but chances are you may think that it still looks ugly. But it's not democratic in that sense of it's not built so that just the average person can look at it and say, and the great architect Richard Morris Hunt had a great essay about this. He wanted his buildings, his Beaux-Arts, great Beaux-Arts structures that he built, like the front of the Metropolitan Museum in New York, and many other structures like that. He wanted people to be able to look at it and say, the average person walking into it, to say, I know I am in a place of great culture and great art now based on what I am walking into, the building I am walking into. And he wanted them to feel respect and awe for what they were going to see inside. Or if you designed a courthouse, he wanted them to feel great respect and awe for the law by walking into it. And that's just an example of how both the aesthetic and the ethical combined during that period to serve purposes that I really think are important and frankly I feel are not being served today.
We have about 12-13 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, I should introduce our guest. We're talking with novelist Caleb Carr. He is the author of the bestsellers The Alienist and The Angel of Darkness, and a new book. Those books set in the past, turn of the century in New York. The new book is set in the near future, and the title of that book is Killing Time, published by Random House. Just been out just officially now, I guess, a couple of weeks. So it's in bookstores if you would like to look at it. In addition to his work as a novelist, Caleb Carr has written several volumes of nonfiction. He writes frequently on military and political affairs. If you have questions, comments, you want to call in, you can do that. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. We were talking a little bit earlier about one of the central problems or concerns of the book is this idea of what do we know and how do we know it? And right. The fact that now with the internet, it becomes more difficult to answer that question because there is so much information that one has to ask, where did it come from? How did it get there? Who put it there? What's their agenda? And how do we evaluate it? At the same time, I think eventually one of your characters, the psychiatrist, the man we've talked about, in a sense comes to the point where he has to say, well, this is just something we're going to have to live with. Is it possible to make one's peace with the information?
Well, you've always got to make peace with something that you can't overcome or that you can't change. And he says that in a moment of tremendous resignation. He says, you know, this is just part of the advance of technology, and we're never going to be able to really affect it. He doesn't really believe that. He's just gone through an extremely traumatic series of experiences that have sort of led him to believe that what they're doing is no better. It's by using technology to try to fight technology that what they end up doing through these hoaxes is no better than what the people who are behind the manipulation of society for their own ends are doing in the first place. And that's a dilemma that is eventually resolved in the conclusion of the book. But it can leave you, and it can end up leaving you feeling utterly overwhelmed. What's going on with information technology? It can, you know, the pervasiveness of it, the total irresponsibility of people who are operating it, the avarice of the people who are operating it, and also the sense with which it really does invade your life. And you know, people have talked a lot about the erosion of privacy as a concept in this country. That's happening largely through the internet and through information technology. And it's a tremendously dangerous thing. Privacy is such a pillar of individual freedom in the American sense, and the erosion of it is more insidious than most people can imagine. You know, there's a tremendous tendency to be resigned about it and to say, well, you know, what does it really matter if everybody knows this, that, or the other about me? And it matters a great deal. It matters a great deal to the quality of your life in terms of how much you are going to be, not only in even more critical ways, but just in terms of the daily quality of your life, how much you are going to be bombarded, manipulated, annoyed, irritated, harassed by these kind of endless marketing and commercial campaigns, which end up taking up so much time that people really have very little time for other traditional activities.
Let's talk with another caller. This is Champaign, and it's line one. Hello.
Hello. Good morning, Mr. Carr.
Good morning.
I saw you the other day on one of the morning shows and talking about your book, and I was really intrigued. And I heard an earlier caller today mention Jack London's The Iron Heel.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that, you know, I can fathom that you could be, you know, come close to saying things that might occur is, for instance, in Jack London's book, The Iron Heel, the thing that really caught my attention was that book was written about 1915 or 1916, 30 years before World War II. And in his book, he mentioned that Hawaii would be attacked by the Germans, and
right.
He wasn't far off.
No, it's very true. I hadn't realized that the Iron Heel was quite that late, but it's following the same principle as H.G. Wells. If you know his book, The Shape of Things to Come, was sort of the same kind of thing. If you've studied history, and if you make a study of as London did as a reporter of the social and political conditions around you, it's really, you know, not tremendously difficult to make a not necessarily an accurate, because none of us will be totally accurate, but a plausible projection into the future, and that becomes much more plausible than, say, you know, the stuff of science fiction in Hollywood, say that something like The Matrix, which, when you strip away all the wonderful special effects involved in it, is really nothing more than a sort of an old pulp magazine story about evil robots taking over the world. But there is a tradition of really, intelligently researched speculative fiction, and that's really the tradition out of which this book grows. Whether it succeeds or not is up to every reader to decide. But that's the tradition that I readily acknowledge that this book grows out of, and Wells too had a lot of predictions that were again involving the Germans, unfortunately, that were that proved to be extremely accurate at his time. So there is a tradition for this sort of thing.
Mr. Carr,
mm-hmm.
I really appreciate the work that you're doing in this book, and I'm thinking about purchasing the book. And you know, it's just nice to hear a little bit of reality now and then instead of the mythology we get on a daily basis from the media. And I that's all I had to say. Thank you very much.
Right.
Well, I thank you. It is hard with the mythology of the media, and all you have to remember when listening to that is that, you know, the networks at this point are not their own people. You know, the tendency toward merger and conglomeration in terms of information delivery, which includes the media, is unfortunately, you know, well advanced. And just as we had major trust busting activities in the beginning of this century, we will have to face the fact that we can't have so many sources of information and what is called entertainment controlled by so few corporate entities who really don't operate under very much regulation at all.
Hmm. You know, one of the things, to ask a different sort of question about your writing, one of the things that Killing Time has in common with The Alienist and The Angel of Darkness is that they're ensemble casts.
Right.
And that's something that you like? You like writing for the group?
Yeah, I mean, everybody writes. People have asked me, they said, you know, gee, the bunch of people in Killing Time seem sort of like the bunch of people in The Alienist. And there are differences. There are clear differences, for instance, in Killing Time, which was a big gripe in Hollywood about The Alienist, that there was no love story. Well, there is a love story in Killing Time. So there are differences. But every writer has the kinds of personal relationships that they're most comfortable writing with. Many people write love stories. That's the kind of relationship that they want to most explore. For me, it happens to be these kind of close-knit groups of friends who undertake a project or a mission together. It can be anything from, you know, just a hobby that they all share to right up to something like what happens in this book, right up to some kind of pranksterism or even subversive behavior. These are the kind of relationships that really that I really understand, that I've always engaged in my life, and it's what I really like to write about.
Well, on behalf of all of those folks who enjoyed The Alienist and The Angel of Darkness, I would be remiss if I didn't ask, will there be more books about these people?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there's no nobody should be under any concern about that. It's, you know, we just, I did not want to suffer from the Conan Doyle syndrome, where you become so sick of your characters that you end up wanting to kill him off the way he had to kill off Sherlock Holmes, and then was forced by the public to bring him back to life. I don't ever want to get that way with those characters, really, because by the end of his life, Conan Doyle couldn't even barely stand to mention Sherlock Holmes' name. I don't really want to ever reach that point with these characters. So the way to do that is to, you know, and also one doesn't really want to be pigeonholed as just doing one thing. It becomes, you know, for the writer, it becomes creatively very stifling. So you try to break out, do other things. It's hard to get people to accept it when you break out and do other things, but it's really a necessary process.
Hmm. You just mentioned Hollywood in passing. I gather that at one time there was some talk about making a movie version of The Alienist.
Yeah, there still is. It's gone on and on and on because, again, it has elements that are difficult for Hollywood. The lack of the love story, the subject matter is obviously a little difficult. For a straight ahead Hollywood movie, and sadly, you know, Hollywood right now is in a very bad state of affairs in terms of what the kind of material that they choose to make, and the ensemble cast is difficult for them. Ensemble casting is something that the British have traditionally done much better than Americans, but it you know, there's always the chance that it'll get revived and that it'll end up happening. Just a matter of time.
So what are you working on right now?
Really, I'm just working on getting through this book tour for Killing Time. It's the publishing business has gotten to be like the movie business a little bit, in the sense that there's a rapid turnaround. I only did the final edit on Killing Time about 3 months ago, and then it was published very quickly. So I haven't had time to really work on anything else, and I'm kind of just I'm going around making people aware of the book, and at that point, when that's done, I will sit down and figure out what I will do next.
Well, I guess we'll stop. We've come to the end of the time for this hour. We want to thank you very much for spending some time talking with us today.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
We appreciate it. Our guest once again, Caleb Carr. And if you're interested in reading his new book, the one we've been talking about, the title of the book is Killing Time, and it's published by Random House. It's only been out a couple of weeks now. And also, you might go back and look at his other novels, The Alienist and The Angel of Darkness. They are both now available in paperback.